Welcome to Season 9, Episode 3 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we decide to take up the RPG Blog Carnival and talk a little bit about rethinking encounters. We're out to discuss house rules. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 3 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me is Chris and Paul. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hope everyone had a good 2 weeks off. I had, well, as I think I've told you, both of you, I've had a little bit of misadventures this go-around. My left hand is not as good as it should be.
Well, this is still there.
Yeah, you know... It sounds stupid, folks, but I got 8 stitches in the tip of my left pinky.
Oh. Ow. Right on the nerve.
Yeah, you know, and it was the most freakish accident on the planet. I accidentally knocked over my beer glass at the bar, went to go pick it up just to set it upright, and I don't know, as I was doing that, if it shattered or popped. I think it shattered. Other people said they heard a pop, so I have no idea, but it lacerated my the tip of my left pinky, and I had to get 8 stitches.
Oh, that's not how you want to end a night at a bar.
So there you go, folks. I lost 1 hit point.
The proverbial cat attack.
So there you go. Don't. So watch out what you do at the bar, folks.
Oh, definitely.
A buddy of mine said, "What happened? Did a sniper take out the glass?" Like, no, that nothing like that.
Yeah.
So, other than that, everyone else is doing okay, right?
Yes.
No injuries, no sicknesses.
Nope, doing good.
All right then. Then I say, let's hit some news, shall we? Which is. I don't know if I should bring this one up because it's so silly. I was saying I wasn't going to, but apparently I'm going to just because I'm not trying to say that these people are silly. I find it amusing just because it's definitely nothing I would ever do. But supposedly there will now be an official My Little Ponies RPG.
Well, wasn't there a Fate version of that too? I thought there was already a Fate.
That was the complaint in the article I was reading. That was the complaint was, it's like there are kind of, the problem is that they're a little late to the table because there's already stuff out there that kind of fills that little niche market. So we'll see. I just think that's hilarious. Now, as the article was pointing out, it's like, you know, My Little Pony is owned by
Hasbro.
Right. And it's like, it's surprising that they haven't done something sooner.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, also, this could be a good gateway as long as they, you know, as long as they use a system simple enough and not, I would not recommend using Fate for something like this.
Yeah.
But as long as they use something simple enough, it could be a great game to get kids into it, too.
Well, you know, and I kind of get that. But, you know, I mean, if I was going to go that route, I would probably do Third Eye Games' Mermaid Adventures.
Yeah.
Well, right,
Hasbro has reach, though. I mean, they've got they've got serious reach.
They just screw up way too much. I don't know. Fun fact: do you know what Hasbro started off as?
No, I don't.
School supplies.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, the bro is for brothers, and the has is for something else. I only learned that because I was watching something about G.I. Joe.
Oh,
recently,
nice.
Where they were talking about the original G.I. Joes, you know, the actual 12-inch figures.
Ah, the Megalos.
What was that?
The Megalos.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. The ones that basically, like, I had one of those Spider-Man Megalos, you know, the full 12-inchers. The articulated things that you could take the costume off.
Yeah, and I mean, they're... It is quite amazing, you know, it's like it... Because they created them because it was a counterpose to Barbie. You know, girls had Barbie at the time. I mean, this is, we're talking 50s. And boys, was it the 50s, 60s? It was think it was the late 50s, early 60s for it.
Was it? I thought G.I. Joe was a little earlier than that, but I could be wrong.
Well, it was definitely the 50s, and they were saying that they patterned a lot of the G.I. Joes after World War II, because World War II was still near and dear to everyone's heart at the time.
Right. Yep.
So, and eventually, as like the Vietnam War started going on, they started making G.I. Joe more a man of adventure rather than an actual soldier.
Yeah. 64, by the way.
What was it?
1964, if Wikipedia is to be believed.
Yeah. And then, of course, supposedly, they had to stop production of them, mainly because of the gas crisis in the 70s. Petroleum was so expensive. Plastic was becoming really expensive.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Which is why in the 80s, it was reborn as a 3S Freak.
Yeah. Well, again, they also built like an entire terrorist organization based around a used car salesman. That's actually pretty bloody impressive.
All right. So let's get to some Kickstarter, shall we? All right, sure. First up, let's see. Let me refresh this page because I'm always curious. Another one of those weird Make 100 ones. Isometric maps with 100 rooms.
So, you used to that?
Yeah. I'm not
it
sure.
I'm a little dubious on the design by you thing.
Yep.
100 rooms designed by you.
Yeah, that means that you're probably going to end up doing a lot of the work yourself.
Yeah, basically, if you always have a high quality, that would be... Yeah. It's just one of those crazy things. I mean, the sad thing is I've seen people who actually do really well, really good isometric maps. It's one of those things that I never really could do. I remember actually seeing... The first time I ever saw an isometric map, it was in... The Dungeoneering Survival Guide.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, and I was just like, well, that's cool. I don't think I could draw like that, but that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it really was, you know, because it had, and I always thought, well, you know, because, I mean, that's always been one of my biggest problems with maps, was it's like sometimes there's three-dimensional information, and how do you really properly convey it?
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the few ways you can possibly do that. You know, because otherwise you're just looking at a 2D map. And even if you have, I mean, you take, let's just take B2, Keep on the Borderlands, you know. There's that whole series of caves, and there's actually a graduate on the hill.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, yep. And it's like, unless you know that, you just look at the 2D map, oh, it's flat. No, it's not. There's actually, you know, the tunnels would actually go up. So, I don't know. It's just one of those strange things.
It's interesting. It's an intriguing idea, I think.
Yeah. So they're asking $12 for a digital download of the map. But it's weird because it's supposedly a hunt make 100, so that means after 100 backers, you're done. So why are you even having different levels? It makes no sense.
Is that the initiative of the make 100? I thought the make 100 was to make like 100 premium items.
I don't know. I mean, different people have done it different ways. Oh, I guess make 100. This is 100 maps. I don't know what the make 100 means, because the last one that we had was he was only having 100 backers.
Right. And you'll see that on a couple of the other ones here. But if you notice that the $55 pledge level, there are only 100 of them, whereas the $49 pledge level.
Oh, I see. See, so this one's different and this one's smarter than the other one.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know. I could give or take it.
It'll be fun. It's an experimental exercise. He's got almost a full month to go, but he's already kind of like fifth there. It's possible to make it.
Possible, yeah.
You know.
And it's supposed to deliver this summer, so.
Yeah, and the maps look decent enough. Like, I kind of like his map of Scurvy Dice, the early map design, where it looks almost like a pirate treasure map. And seems to know his stuff, so we'll see if he has the incentive, you know, if he gets the backing or not.
Yeah. All right, so next up I have The Claw of Madness. Basically, this is the adventure that was already Kickstarted, but it was not available as a Pathfinder adventure module. This is the Pathfinder conversion. And it actually already successfully funded. They were only asking for $538, roughly. Mm-hmm. And so you can get the PDF for about $9 US.
Yep, and a printed version for about $27. So, this plus shipping.
This is one of those ones that I would almost just get the PDF and just print it myself.
Yeah.
Unless you really must have. I think I've said this before. I like getting, these days I like getting adventures in PDF format because then I can have them. They don't take up any space. And if I need them, I print them out. I can make notes on the pages and then recycle them when I'm done. Mm-hmm. So that's just me. I do remember when this came out. I think we talked about this Kickstarter when it had come out originally, the original one.
Oh, what system was it originally for 5e or?
I think so. There's a link. Hold on. Let me see. Yeah, that was for 5th edition.
Okay.
Yeah.
It definitely catches your attention with the cover, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was a very unique cover. All right, so next up was one that we could have used last week, which was Cold Shadows Narrative Espionage Role-Playing.
Indeed.
And they actually were asking for $5,000 U.S. They're up.
Yeah, they've blown through that.
They're almost up to $22,000.
That's pretty bloody impressive for a third partier.
Yeah.
He's involved in this sucker.
You know.
Well, yeah, they got some impressive names on this one, though.
$10 for the PDF package, which includes the Cold Shadows PDF, the Black Book PDF, and any digital stretch goals that they reach. That's not bad.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious to see what sort of system they use.
Yeah.
It's the Blood and Honor system by John Wick for John Wick's Blood and Honor stuff. I don't know much about it. I haven't really looked into it at all. So
yeah.
I'm really intrigued by this one and trying to decide whether or not I want to do a PDF or actually just dive in and get the physical version.
The $20 rule. The $20 includes the soft cover core rulebook and then the PDFs. That's not too bad.
Yeah, that might be worth it.
I mean, you get the Cold Shadows core rulebook and then the Black Shadows book as a PDF and then a digital stretch goals. And that's it. Actually, that's not bad.
No, it's not.
You know, because the next one up from there is like $40, and that includes things like dice and tokens and some other stuff. And it's still only the soft cover rule book.
Yeah.
So
plus, they've already locked a whole schlocking of kicks, you know, stretch goals.
Yeah, because what do they have for stretch goals right now?
Well, they've already blown through most of them. They only have a couple left.
Yeah, I mean, they just have, you know, that's all. That's not bad. I mean, you get all the anything that's that could possibly digital, you get. So, it'd almost be worth it to back it at $10.
Yeah.
Yeah, not disagreeing there.
And they got 23 days to go.
Yeah, plus their largest one, the Honorable Operative, is already sold out. So, if they only wanted 100 backers, they got all 100 already.
Yep, that's the Make 100 initiative, I think.
Yeah.
So, it's going to definitely go on my short list, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, 24-hour rule on this one, though.
All right, so then we have Savage Worlds Zombie Squad, which is a science fiction from the description. You are ex-military criminals sent on suicide missions on the edge of space. Science fiction tabletop RPGs using Savage Worlds. And they've actually blew past their goal. They were asking for about $1,250 USD, roughly. I mean, it's from the UK. They've passed that goal. What was it?
Sorry. You know what this game reminds me of? There was this old arcade game called Xenophobe, where you'd run around the ship beating up on aliens.
I kind of remember that.
Yeah, like it was lit up. You had a 3 split screen, and it would show you how many people you have would show how many screens were slit off.
Right.
Like one on the top level, one in the middle level, one on the bottom level. And you're basically running around grabbing guns and shooting things.
I remember that.
Sucker. So it's already gotten a bit of a nostalgia for me right there.
Yeah.
Plus, Savage Worlds, which should play well enough. So
yeah.
I see a lot of potential. And if it's already paid for the stuff, that's actually half the battle right there.
And they've, you know, they only have like 2 other stretch goals that they haven't unlocked already.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, plus they've already unlocked the category stuff you asked for. How could you ask for more than that?
Yeah. And, I mean, what are they asking for? The PDF? Anything?
think it's $13.
Well, here's the weird thing. You have to spend $25 to get like the first three stretch goals as PDFs. So in other words, only at certain levels are you getting anything that's stretch goals.
Yeah.
At $38, okay, that's when you get the soft cover book and all the stretch goals. That's still not that bad.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And I mean, I'm sure it wouldn't, you know, they don't say, let me see, do they say? You also need the World Science Fiction Companion, which is not on, which is not surprising. So, kind of cool. This one I threw in here just because I thought it was goofy, which was the, obviously you need a 3D printer, but the Infinity Station 3D printable science fiction terrain. So, if you need some science fiction corridors, this guy has some models you can print up.
Yeah, who doesn't?
So,
you know, if you want to ever relive your old Outland experiences, now you have a chance.
So, yeah. I don't know. Again, kind of cool, but I don't have any use for it right now.
I don't have any space for it, even though it looks great.
Yeah, that's the other problem. So, okay.
Well, and it's kind of weird because you... Okay, so it's the different tile sets. Mm-hmm. At the different pledge levels get you different tile sets.
Yeah.
Or different texture sets, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me... Yeah, it kind of reminds me of those old Fisher-Price toys, the way it locks together.
Yeah.
It basically clips in like a claw into the clips. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Looks good. Looks pretty.
Yeah.
All right. So next up, we have City of Sands for 5th edition in Pathfinder, which is part two of an adventure set, apparently. Because what they say, part two of the Fates of the Forebears adventures. And I'm like, well, that only helps you if you've done the first Kickstarter. Right?
Well, I'm sure the other one's available via drive-through RPG or something like that.
Yeah.
The previous module was what? The Domes of Ishak Zahur?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Yeah.
So,
basically trying to go political adventure.
Yeah, this is just one of those ones. I'm like, okay. Again.
Well, it's interesting that they don't offer the Domes of Ishak Zahur as one of the pledge levels. Yeah. It seems like that would be a good idea.
Yeah, at least if nothing else, even if you don't print up any more copies, it should be like a PDF. The thing here.
Oh, you can. It's an add-on. And if you look down below, it's a $30 add-on.
$30
For the printed version. Otherwise, it's $15 for the PDF version.
Okay. It's reminding me of
others. Okay, because it's like this by itself. This thing's a $15 for the PDF if you don't do the early bird.
So. Yeah, I won't go into early bird things either. That's It looks like they got a ways to go, though.
Yeah. So we'll see. So here's one that should be near and dear to at least one of our host parts, the New Mexicon 2017.
Indeed.
So the Albuquerque convention. Yep. And we were talking earlier that I'm seeing more and more conventions pop up this way. Mm-hmm. Yep. So.
And they're focusing on like the smaller press indie role-playing games like Fiasco and Microscope and that kind of thing. So,
you know what? I don't have a problem with that because I think we need that. Because, I mean, really, even though I'm going to be playing a 5th edition D&D game, I don't really enjoy playing a lot of the bigger games anymore. I could argue that Savage Worlds is a big game, but...
I think a lot of the smaller stuff like that also may lend itself a little better to those quick sessions. I know, like, for example, when I was playing Dungeon World would require some pretty heavy work by the GM to extend it because we blew through the first 10 levels of characters in 6 months, playing once every 2 weeks.
I guess it's better finding out how long you want to play your game when it comes down to it there.
And so, you know, something like Dungeon World would be ideal for this, where you can, like, you know, you just tick off a couple of boxes and your character's ready to go.
Yeah.
So 4 hours, bada bing, bada bam.
So what are they? Let's see. Mm, Okay, so $40 for the pass and the PDF bundle. But if you just don't want, if you just want the PDF bundle for their thing, it's $20. That's kind of a cool. I don't know what's in their PDF bundle. I didn't read that.
Let's see here: The Quiet Year, The Dark Forest, Spark, Houses of the Blooded, Bulldogs, The Fate Core Edition, The Plays the Thing, The Cold Ruled. Cold Ruins of Last Life, Godsend Agenda, and Velvet Glove. Huh. They have a list down there.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah,
it kind of blows my mind when I'm looking at some of the people involved. It looks like that Magpies Games is really playing a big part in this thing, which is kind of cool because they created one of my favorite games that I have yet to play, Underground. Or what happens when you play traumatized characters in Reagan's America? Superheroes.
What's the name of the game?
Underworld, or Underground.
Underground, okay.
It was done by Magpies Games back in the day. Long story short, they basically mutated soldiers, sent them out to fight wars in the middle of nowhere, and then they bring them back and they don't support them. So you're playing essentially metahuman veterans.
So it's Universal Soldier, the role-playing game.
More or less. And then you're back in the streets, and this is the one that actually had a fast food cannibalism restaurant, so take it what you will.
Kato kind of reminds me of like one of the episodes of Star Trek, The Next Generation. Didn't they have like some soldiers that they were holding in prison or something like that? There was like some
I think I remember something in the back of that.
You know, the society had created basically super soldiers, and then when their war was done, since their society was normally peaceful outside of the super soldiers because they were trained to be violent. You know, they decided it wasn't worth the effort of trying to reintegrate them back into their own society, so they just kind of imprisoned them. I don't know. Anyway, why don't we get on to the other Kickstarters, because we want to get into our topics, right?
Yes, we do.
All right. We have Slave New World, a 10-level Pathfinder D&D 5th edition adventure. And basically, it's families and friends have been taken as slaves, and the only way to get them back is to lead a slave rebellion and win a war.
Mm-hmm. It's only $60. Gonna make it.
Yeah, I don't think so. Interesting. It only has 4 days to go. I just bring it up because it's an interesting idea. But
it looks well laid out for the most part, and I like the art. I don't think it was marketed properly, ultimately. But.
Well, and $45 for a PDF is
a little insane.
That's starting to put, especially when, you know, how many Pathfinder adventure paths are out there now?
A lot.
And same thing for D&D. Even D&D's got, almost half a dozen 5e official adventure paths. I mean, you're going to have to compete with that, and, you know, I just don't.
Yeah, the guy only has one backer.
did he actually get a backer? Mine says zero.
Mine says one.
$6 more. It's right in the back. He basically bought the Rebellion Leader thing. You know, it looks beautiful. Like, the art's amazing. It's just, you know.
Yeah. Well. All right, let's get to something that I love that I don't use a lot, which is obviously miniatures. And there's a Kickstarter for Dungeon Accessories. And so this guy has some pillars, some tables and chairs, some chests, and looks like bottles and vases, and looks like a little fire brazier and some rats.
Yep.
So I think
this hand painted. Everything's hand painted, so.
Oh, it looks fantastic. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they've reached their goal. They were asking only $3,000. They have almost $20,000.
The only thing I was a little concerned about is I looked down and I looked at the scale.
Yeah.
These things are not big. They are quite small, actually.
Well, and that's appropriate to a 28-millimeter figure. Mm-hmm. They're not that big.
I suppose, yeah.
You know, I got news for you. A chest is not that big.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of the stuff is small, so you could lose it. But still, I think kind of
looks
cool.
Really good, though.
Oh no, it's amazing. It's just definitely tell this had a lot of heart and soul set up here.
Yeah. So, if you need some of these pieces, it might be something to get in on because he has different levels based on what you need. Unless you want everything, I think, which is $55. Includes all three sets. The giant rats, the tables and chairs, and the treasure chests. Mm-hmm. And unless you want to actually spend $250 and ask them to create your own accessory piece, I don't know why you would want that.
Yeah, that's a little excessive. Unless it's something really out of the ordinary. Like, I wouldn't want to do it for, like, a door or something.
Yeah. So, still kind of cool. I like it. And they're out of San Antonio, Texas. And last but not least is the one Kickstarter that I'm kind of depressed about.
This is a weird
And just in terms of the backing, it is the Ultimate Apocalyptic Planet, 77 Worlds RPG from James M. Ward. You know, we're talking Metamorphos Alpha, Gamma World.
Yeah, I mean, he's an iconic name in the RPG industry. And this is kind of, I mean, it's barely reached its halfway point. And, I mean, granted, they got 33 days to go, but still.
Yeah, I'm really shocked, so.
Yeah. The production looks a little odd.
I think it's just it's not marketed properly.
Yeah, I think that the graphic design is honestly it's not attractive. I'll just come out and say it. It's not a pretty looking design at this point.
Well, it feels like something that was made in the 70s, and it definitely has that effect. Like I like it, but it's I don't know quite over there. Yeah, I heard about this on Podcast at Ground Zero. Jared was talking about this sucker. And yeah, now that I've seen it, I'm on the fence. I'm going to have to decide.
Yeah.
You want to support the artist, especially somebody like James M. Ward, for God's sake, you know, considering how much of an influence he had on gaming. You kind of want to throw some money at him.
Yeah, sadly, I just don't have the money.
I understand completely.
So.
Oh man, he's gone almost like Steve Jackson because you look at some of the stuff and he's got all sorts of crazy crap at the higher levels.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen though.
No.
All right.
Something like this should have hit its goal pretty quick though. So, but anyway.
I think so. All right, so why don't we get into the fun and which is obviously the first topic, which is from the RPG Blar Carnival, which has been running for quite some time. It actually predates the RPG Bloggers Network, RPGBN. And, you know, I mean, when I ran the competitor to the RPG Bloggers Network, the RPGBA, the RPG Blog Alliance, you know, we obviously participated in some of the carnivals as well. And so what happens is every month in the carnival, there's a topic, and people write blog posts about it, and, you know, this isn't a blog, but this is a podcast, which is sort of an audio blog, right?
Yep.
So I thought it was an interesting idea. And the topic this month is rethinking encounters. You know, because let's face it, the encounters in general are kind of a very boring thing. You know, for most D&D encounters, it goes something like this. You run into a monster. You smash monster, you gain XP, money, gold, maybe something, maybe information.
Yeah, I can see that.
That's it. So, you know, the question is obviously, you know, I mean, there's so many different ways you can approach this. And as they talk about, there's some topics you can choose to explore even within this general omnibus. But
I think any GM worth his salt is always trying to rethink encounters. I mean, at least I know I am.
Well, you know, because I always question, it's like, what exactly is an encounter? Does there have to be, you know, and I know 4th edition, I think, touched on this some, at some level, because I think they had, that's where the whole challenges came through, right? You know, because one other thing, I didn't play 4th edition, I only heard some of it 4th hand, so you'll have to excuse me. But, and, you know, one of the things about encounters is, does it necessarily have to be a combat encounter? You know, can an encounter just be a negotiation between two people?
Yeah.
You know.
I think.
What was that?
Oh, well, for starters, let's go to what Pathfinder says an encounter should be.
All right, let's go with that.
An encounter is a short scene in which the PCs actively do something. Examples of encounters include combat with a monster, a social interaction significant to the adventure's plot, an attempt to disarm a trap, or the discovery of a mystery or clue requiring further investigation. In short, an encounter requires party participation, at least according to them, and that makes a lot of sense. As long as they're doing something and it's basically in a contained unit, it makes, that gives you at least a definition to work with, nothing else.
Right, because I'm that, and that includes some of the stuff that, you know, again, traditionally we don't necessarily think an encounter is. You know, yeah. I would necessarily always thought that an encounter would be finding a clue.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, again, like, it could be any number of things there. Like, I hate to go to my legendary campaign, Space Ninjas, which my buddy Joe's running, but he's done such insane things with it. We were going to have a fight, and it ended up becoming a Yo Mama joke at interval, but it was still proactive. And as silly as it was very fun and an experience where we got to basically stretch our chops while rolling dice.
Well, another thing about an encounter is that I think it needs to be dynamic. Yes. You know, if your players face off against monsters, one of the things that I know that a lot of GMs and such forget, especially in D&D, is that monsters have morale ratings. Well, every monster is going
to
hang around
and fight
you
to the death.
Butcher it. Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, monsters get distracted too. I just recently had a troll chase after a horse when it was fighting the players because it was like, hey, I like horse flesh, and so it took off. You know, by having your scenes dynamic and, you know, fluid, instead of like, okay, well, now you guys are on this side of the clearing and they're on that side of the clearing, and okay, everybody just charges each other till everybody, one side is dead.
Right. And I mean, and the funny thing is a lot of people never understood that. Like, for example, I played recently, not recently, but a while back, I was doing Tour of Darkness, which is Savage World, Vietnam, with the strangeness that is, you know, strange things happening. And in one of the adventures, they were on like a dug-in position, and the bad guys were assaulting their line. And it's like, you know, the bad guys would take some losses, and they'd leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the players are like, what? Of course. Why would you, you know, why would you continue pressing an assault if you're dying? It makes no sense.
If you're getting butchered on open ground, you're not going to stand around and wait for
it. It's just like tactics-wise. You know, people sometimes think that, oh, the other guy's the bad guy. He's not going to use any tactics. What the hell are you talking about? I mean, I know I've done that to PCs. They're like, what are those guys doing? Oh, I don't know. I think those two guys are providing suppressive fire while the rest of the guys run away. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think?
Well, and I mean, like, especially 3rd edition, I think, 3rd edition Pathfinder were notorious for this, is that a lot of the monsters are built on the idea of special abilities. Well, as a GM, you need to make sure you keep all those special abilities in mind, especially some of the higher level monsters. Those special abilities were significant, and there were a number of them that you needed to keep your eye on.
Not only
in order to balance that encounter with the players.
Well, not only special abilities, just sometimes monsters have feats, and you're just like, I don't know what that feat does. I don't keep track of all those. I mean, as a player character, you can barely keep track of the few feats that I know I have.
Exactly.
You know, which is one of the biggest problems that I have with all the feats. It's really hard sometimes. And I mean, I run into this even to Savage World with edges sometimes, just like, I don't know what that edge does. You know, so it's like, you know, outside of a few of them, it's like, okay, he's level-headed, which means he gets 2 cards. Great. Or he's quick, so anything under a 5, he gets to reroll. That's easy enough, you know? But, you know, you get into some of the weird ones, just like, I don't know what that does. Sometimes, I think, especially in some of the encounters would have gone drastically differently if you hadn't remembered to use the monster's edges or feats or whatever. And you're just like... Yep. That's why I don't like using them. It's like, that's why those things, honestly, to a certain degree, should just be explained in the description of the monster. And I know that people say, well, the reason they have feats is they don't have to keep repenting that stuff. I understand that, but that's not the point. The point is, when you're doing the encounter as a game master, you cannot remember everything.
No. Right.
And also, you should have like a rudimentary text of what they're going to do until they run into the party members.
Right.
Like, this is what they want to do for their winning conditions.
Right.
Whether or not they throw it out or have to change it based on the players, that remains to be seen.
Right. Well, not only that, it's like
a lot of different.
I mean, go ahead. I was just thinking. You're right. I mean, it's like, what's the opposing group's goals? What do they want out of an encounter? If an encounter happens, what's their, you know, What do they hope to accomplish? Do they want to? Are they want to kill all the player characters, or do they want to capture the player characters, or they just want to kind of hold off the player characters and run away? Is that what's their win scenario? Mm-hmm. Because everyone has a different one. You know, like let's say you have, you know, and sometimes it's just obviously a game master call. It's like, well, if I was this guy, you know, I would want to, if I ran into the party, I would want to just engage them long enough to be able to disengage from them and run away.
Or what if you run into a group of fellow treasure hunters? They're saying, okay, you two guys hold it out. The rest of us, we're going to fill up our swag and get the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically we steal all your loot.
And I mean, what about what happens when you run into when it turns into a three-sided soccer game, where all of a sudden you know you have two opposing parties and a third party shows up that is maybe not friendly to either side. Yeah, so suddenly you have you know a different dimension to this encounter.
You can either have a temporary ally or a temporary enemy, depending.
Yes.
Yeah.
Time is another factor too. There's all these dimensions to encounters that I don't think you can incorporate them every dimension into every single encounter unless you're some kind of super genius or something like that. But
well,
time is another one.
Yeah, time management in general. I mean, I was talking to someone about adventures the other day, and it's the same thing. It's like, well, the party wants to leave the dungeon and go resupply. How long is that going to take? About 2 weeks of travel time. Well, what the hell's going to be going on in the dungeon? Whatever they're trying to stop probably is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know? And sometimes I actually, as a game master, back in the old days when I first played D&D, I would punish the players that way. You know? And I've kind of started coming back around to the theory that maybe you should do that sometimes. It's like, you know what? You guys need to learn that this is not a video game where you just get to stop. You know? And
yeah, you get back and it's fully repopulated. But we cleared it out. That was 4 weeks ago.
Right, exactly.
They recruited some new friends.
Well, not only that, but defenses could have changed. But again, a lot of that just has to do with the game master, and that's a lot of effort on the game master. I mean, the thing about a dungeon is it is a snapshot of the dungeon at a particular time. It is assuming when the players first enter the dungeon.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, I sometimes think that with certain adventures, it'd be nice to have a way to say, well, this is the event, this is where everything is at point A. You know, 6 hours into the dungeon, this is the status of the dungeon. And then, at 12 hours, it's going to be this status. If there's like some sort of real time sensitive thing, like let's say, oh, I don't know, there's a bad guy and he's trying to raise an undead army and you have to stop him. Maybe that's your goal.
Yeah.
Well,
I have a buddy of mine who basically it was at a TreeCon quite a few months ago where he kept running the same dungeon over and over again, and whatever a party went through the next time interval, they would affect the dungeon. So some stuff would get moved, some stuff would get marked, some things would die, some things would move in, and there was always a change in the dungeon itself because of the different parties that were going through, because we're all a bunch of first level bumpkins and most of us are going to die.
Yeah.
Also, if you think about patrols, if you have, let's say you have a concerted effort in a dungeon, let's say an army is gathering there or something like that, patrols are going to come by on a regular basis. So if you run into a patrol, take them out or try to gather information from them, it takes time to get that information, to drag their bodies into another room and then interrogate them and stuff like that. By the time you're done doing that, another patrol comes by, and then you have to do the same thing all over again to them. Well, two patrols missing suddenly indicates that there's probably a problem in there. That next patrol is probably not going to be just a couple of low-level guys. They're going to be gunning for you.
Yeah. At the same time, you could use that to your advantage, set up a trap, and just wait for him to come to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's part of the fun. Or setting is actually one of the big ones when you're playing with encounters. Like, whether it's a dungeon or whether you're on a set of, let's say you're on a Zeppelin, because it's a pulp game. And that encounter alone, when you're fighting Nazis on the top of a Zeppelin above the Atlantic Ocean, because you're a bunch of two-fisted heroes, and you have to get the MacGuffin away from Dr. Heinrich, insert name, evil bad guy, upon bad guy here.
All of a sudden, you're saying Atlantic and Zeppelin. The only thing that I'm having a flashback is some Call of the Cthulhu game that I played where it was set during World War II. We were on a German Zeppelin crossing the Atlantic, and we were attacked by vampires.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's why I didn't think about setting. Mappers, yeah.
Remember Zeppelins.
Yeah, setting is definitely interesting. You know, there's it. I mean, because it affects, you know, for everything. Example, it affects everything. Yeah, I mean, it affects your line of sight, your ranges for your distance weapons, being spotted, spotting other things, what you can and can't accomplish in a certain amount of time. I mean, if you're in thick woods as opposed to cleared woods, your lines of sight are a lot different.
Well, you know, I think that's where it's interesting, where hopefully, you know, like, for example, in Savage Worlds, there's a bunch of rules on cover, and I know every game has some sort of rules on cover, but especially in Savage Worlds, you know, it's pretty easy. And it's like, as a game master, you need to design your terrain to be able to provide people cover from time to time, even if it's something like, oh, I'm in a bar. Well, I have some cover from the table, you know, or whatever. I knock over the table, I have at least partial cover, whatever the case may be, you know. And I think that gets to Aaron Alston and the original Ninja Hero supplement. And I'm sure he reproduced it in other supplements that he did for Champions. He wrote something about talking about setting and how, you know, you need to make the action exciting if you're going to have a fight. You know, and you can have a fight anywhere. It's like, oh, a fight on in a street is pretty boring, but a fight on top of a moving train is exciting.
Mm-hmm. Especially in a dodge for the tunnel.
You know? So, and I mean, in some ways, that's the other thing. It's like, especially with encounters, are there certain rules to the encounters that are not normal? I mean, because that's the other thing, you know, that environment especially can play. And you were talking about, obviously, terrain, where you have highers and lowers. You know, is someone able to get up on top of a ridge? Does it have more line of sight than someone else? Because that's the other thing with cover. People forget where anyone is, there's an X, Y, and Z coordinate. There's X, Y, and Z, which is altitude. And you can be higher than lower than ground level, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, and so someone who's flying above the battlefield gets to see everybody. However, everyone gets to see you.
Yep.
You know. Absolutely. So
flying kind of sucks in a world with automatic weapons.
And then, I mean, even if you look at the very definition that Paizo has, they talk about combat with a monster, searching for a clue, and disarming a trap. What if all of those three are in play at once? Mm-hmm. You're being attacked, but you need to find this vital clue, and there's a timed trap in the same room, which is, I mean, that's kind of evil, but it's not unreasonable.
Well, I think what this gets to is something that I'm going to call the mini game. Mm-hmm. Where, and I mean, this is in Traveler's been accused of being really a collection of mini games. Character creation is a game among it, among itself, in the classic.
Game you can lose.
What was that?
It's a game you can lose.
Yeah. No. But you know, the trading system is a mini game. But, and I've seen this in encounters where the encounter has special rules, and in essence, because it has special rules, especially when there's a time component, it becomes its own game. Even Savage Worlds has done this. Solomon Kane, one of the images of Solomon Kane is, if the volcano explodes, then you have to outrun the lava. Ooh, and there's a chase encounter, so they use the chase rules, sort of, but the lava is one chase, and you have to outrun the lava flow and hopefully reach safety before the lava gets you.
That's a good incentive.
What was that?
That's good incentive.
Right. You know, and hopefully you don't get to the lava, but if you defeat a certain person, then the lava flows, and, you know, you're already next to the volcano, so now then you have to outrun the volcano, which becomes its own thing, and you have to spend a lot of binnies. Gotta re-roll that, because I have to, I gotta dodge the lava.
Or you go with the classic, one of my favorite things, even if it was horribly overused. I'm going to take a page from Doctor Who. The floor is a checkerboard. Why? You could make it into a trap. You could make it into animated statues.
Wasn't Tomb of Horrors like that? Didn't they have a checkerboard in Tomb of Horrors?
I think there is. I can't remember exactly.
There's one of the classic D&D adventures had a chessboard, and it was the floor was a chessboard, and because you magically started at a certain point, and wherever you started, you had to move across the floor like that chess piece.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see that, and it'd be a lot of fun to see where it leads.
Yeah.
You know, as far as that's concerned, especially if your rival opponents are a bunch of constructs, they're based on, well, the chess set.
Yeah.
Or worse, you have to fight as chess, and you find out you're fighting checkers. Really kind of implicit in your head there.
That does remind me of a video game, though. There was like a video game called Battle Chess or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. It was Battle Chess and Battle Chess 2.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, you play chess, but then when you got to the point where both figures were at the same point, you actually had an individual battle.
Yeah.
So whoever won that won the spot. So it didn't matter that your opponent actually was better at chess than you are. You were just better at playing the video game and defeating his guy.
Oh, that reminds me of Archon.
Yep, Archon and Archon 2, I think it was. Yep.
So. Yeah, where they basically had the squares that would light up or dark up, and you basically had a fight.
Yep.
And depending on which side you were on, if you were on the light side, if it was light, you had more power, basically, and vice versa.
And then you could build your own monsters. Anyway.
Reminiscent.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, that's why we remember the most significant of modules, and to a lesser extent, the most significant of locations. Because you're never going to remember your 45th orc hunt, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
But you'll remember if you end up in a race with biplanes
right.
against orcs.
Well, I was just thought to, for some reason, I just started thinking of Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. The infamous first scene.
Yep.
That hole where he's avoiding all those traps after he's setting them off.
Mm-hmm.
That almost to me is an encounter scene.
That is like right out of Dungeon Hacking 101.
Right.
Yep.
But I mean, a lot of people some people would consider that more than, I mean, it's an encounter, but it's not an encounter. It's, I don't know. But it's weird. It's like everyone would consider each trap. It's like, and it's like, it's more interesting if he doesn't get to disarm the traps.
Again, mm-hmm. when you think he's made it, you know he's swaggering his step. He puts the weight on there roughly of equivalent size on for the idol. He walks away. He's pleased, and then it sinks down.
Yeah.
And then all hell breaks loose because you got the giant eight ball chasing him for the good chunk of the adventure.
And not to mention you have the scumbag who decides, I'm not giving you the whip. Go fuck yourself. I'm taking the idol with me.
Well, I mean, you can take scenes from movies and books and stuff like that and dissect them and use those elements in your own encounters. You know, it doesn't have to be a giant rolling ball, but it could be lava coming down or water coming down a hallway that suddenly puts an urgency into this encounter, whether they're trying to, get the last of the coins from the floor of the wherever they're at.
Well, I think that's
any
what
number
it,
of things.
I think that's what it is. Sometimes I think that sense of urgency sometimes is missing from encounters. Does that make
yes.
sense?
No,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, not all encounters have to have a time urgency, but when you look at, when you use obviously books and movies as examples of maintaining a certain level of intensity, I'll use
mm-hmm.
time does play an event. It's like, hey, I got to defeat all these guys and someone's going to have to disarm the bomb. So you have X amount of time. Now, the problem, of course, in the game system is that the combat system doesn't quite work on a second-by-second basis.
Yeah. Well, and there's luck in there.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, your row of three fighter types are defending the technician who's supposed to be defending the bomb, and all three of your fighters are like, okay, well, we all rolled ones. We've all been incapacitated by their stun blasters.
And again, I think this is why games like Savage Worlds that has bennies really helps, because then, you know, you get to use bennies or luck points or whatever the hell you want to call it as kind of a counterbalance. It's a, you know, and as a game master, I wouldn't spend bennies to try to counteract their bennies for that. That would just be a dick move.
No. Yeah, because at that point, you're basically just playing an arms race based on bennies, which is just going to be, you're going to get into a fight and nobody's going to end up happy in the end.
Yeah. The only reason I ever use bennies is if my encounter, if the encounter for me seems too easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, I'll use my guy's bennies to counteract what you guys are doing. But if you guys are having a hard enough time with the encounter for whatever reason, be it because of the time or maybe, I don't know, maybe you guys just aren't rolling horribly, I'm not going to spend bennies, even though my character probably would.
Yeah. Right.
Because it is, you know, to me, that I think that's why I like Savage Worlds, because you get that, as a game master, you get that pacing option where it's like, you don't have to feel as guilty about certain things. It's like, spend bennies here, don't spend bennies here. You know, you use Benny, you know, it's like, oh, you thought of something good, here, have some extra bennies. You know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a legitimate use, too, because as the game master, you are trying to balance things out. So, you know, when an encounter is going really tough for them, and you're not using the bennies, they might be like, well, are you taking it easy yet? Unless I'm like, well, you're only halfway through the adventure. This isn't the big bad.
No.
And so, you know, you can use that to balance that out.
Well,
nobody likes the goblin in the dungeon.
But, you know, that's why I also like Savage Worlds, because bennies are per session. So, you know, if you know something's going to go over two sessions, you know, you're not really worried. You know, it's like, I like it because, you know, and especially if you award bennies, and I've always used the rule where, you know, there's an optional rule in the latest rule book where it's like, oh, if the players draw a joker, everyone gets a Benny as well. Mm-hmm. And it's like, because that way I don't have to remember to pass them out. Everyone just gets bennies because someone's going to draw the joker at some point. Mm-hmm. And it helps for like those short games like that I was running, which was like 2 hours a piece, you know, where I probably wouldn't have enough time to hand out bennies on a normal regular basis. But, oh, everyone gets bennies. There you go. Done. You know, and it's great because people don't feel like, oh, I got to save my... And it's like I don't use the rule, because there used to be a rule where for every Benny you had at the end of the adventure, you could roll a D6, and if you go roll a 5 or a 6, then you get an XP for that Benny you didn't spend. And I'm like, no, I'm doing away with that, because then that just causes, you know, Benny hoarding.
You know? And they're ultimately, they're meant to be spent. Otherwise, you don't get a four-color game or a pulp game.
Right, exactly. So...
And okay, well, I'm going to throw up one last thing, I guess.
All right.
Favorite encounter you've ever cribbed, whether it's from a movie, TV show, book, video game, or another older module.
Favorite encounter I ever cribbed. Jeez.
Yeah, it could be any of them here. Like, you know, I'm not saying your most favorite one you're going to end up.
Well, I'm trying to think of something that I may have borrowed.
Okay. I'll just use one that I did recently, which was just as I was talked about the time element, is that it was a military encampment, and the players ambushed a patrol, and it's, you know, that's a fairly common trope in, you know, name a movie genre, book, action thing, whatever, and the players just hung around, and then another patrol came by, and they hung around some more, and finally a really big patrol came by. So it wasn't anything specific, but I mean, it's a very common trope, and I kind of expected them to see through that and skedaddle, but they didn't.
Yeah, well, sometimes they'll get the message. Okay, I'm going to throw up one of my favorites. Everybody here is familiar with the Goonies?
Yes.
Yep.
I took the Death Trap piano scene, and I put it in the middle of a dungeon. And the bard loved it. Because they were being attacked by essentially animated corpses at the same time, where they had to essentially play a concerto. If they played it right, the room was automated in such a way that it would attack on your behalf. But if you failed on the keyboard, the floor would fall away.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know that I've ever taken something specifically from another source. Nothing I can remember off the top of my head. I usually try to spin them, and then after I spin them for a little while, then they get twisted and morphed into something completely different and end up looking nothing like the original source material.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm sure a lot of our audiences could probably throw some 1001 crazy ideas, which we'd like to hear.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't think I specifically have borrowed an encounter from other materials. Definitely NPCs, people, you know, from movies, and especially movies, because it's easy. It's like I'm doing an imitation of somebody, and that's easy to borrow.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, let's face it, who hasn't, honestly, I don't know if this is true anymore, but I swear I've never met a gamer that has not been able to quote Monty Python and Holy Grail.
Yep, I understand that completely.
You know, and it's like, so who can't start kind of quasi quoting, like acting like the guy watching the bridge, or the Black Knight, or Tim the Sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I guess I've always borrowed. What was that?
And it's only mostly dead.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Princess Bride 2 is another great movie. I mean, I think all of us wish we could have borrowed the fight scene on top of the Cliffs of Insanity.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
You know.
Ego and Wesley's sword fight is probably one of the greatest. Even though, pretty roughly, it's only okay, the emotion, the heft, the fact that they're trying to kill each other, but they're also not trying to kill each other, if that makes any sense. You can tell they're basically for the fight of their lives, but at the same time, it's right out of Errol Flynn's era back in the 80s,
Yeah. Which
was almost unprecedented.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, geez. I love watching Robin Hood, the Errol Flynn Robin Hood back in the day. That was a
just
great movie.
Because
growing up, that would always be showed on like TBS a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I used to watch that a lot. I really do love a lot of the old movies, and a lot of it's because it's like I realize that they're not realistic, and there's a lot of heavy romanticism in what goes on. It's like I like watching John Wayne movies for the same way.
Exactly.
You know,
it's entertaining, and that's also what gaming is for.
Well, that and. Even though John Wayne was wrong, personally, and a lot of things, you know, you couldn't argue with the Duke, you know, the man, you know, all his characters were very uncompromising characters, and there were reasons for that, you know, and you kind of respected him even if you hated him.
Yep.
You know?
I agree completely. Side effect of having integrity even when you're wrong.
Right. I mean, one of my favorite movies, at least from John Wayne, has to be Big Jake. You know, he was an older character. You know, he's an older guy.
Oh, that's right. He's coming out of the middle of nowhere
You know, his family owns this huge ranch, so he's a rich guy, but he's been estranged from his family for a while. You know, his grandson gets kidnapped, and so his wife contacts him to bring him in because he's supposed to deliver a ransom to the kidnappers. Lo and behold, there's both of them decided, we're not paying a ransom. We're just going to kill them all. And get the boy
typical
back.
Typical adventurer mentality, man.
What was that?
Typical adventurer mentality.
But, you know, it's
when they bring the cars and stuff. And the kid in the motorcycle.
Yeah. Actually, one of my favorite scenes in that movie was early on, where it's like there was a Scottish, like, sheep herder guy, and these ranchers are going to hang him. And he's like, I'll give you such and such a dollar a head. There's something about, like, that's robbery. He's like, I don't see any better offers today. And he's like, he's like, I'll take it on one condition. I go with the sheep.
That's a good answer.
You know? And I'm like, that's a great encounter. You know, you wish you could have that encounter, you know, where, you know, it's not even, there's not a real fight. It's just ego versus ego and who wins.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's really hard to pull off in an RPG because... No. You're not. It's not a scene. It's not something that's written, and it's really hard to sometimes role play that out properly.
Not everybody can extemporize to the level of scripted dialogue.
Exactly.
If you know, I'm watching a TV show, and that scripted dialogue sometimes just kind of really stands out. You're like, no one talks like that.
No.
And on top of that, it's always the most important thing of an encounter is player agency.
Yeah.
Like I've talked about in the past, how I love the concept of skill challenges, but it always felt like I wasn't really doing anything other than rolling dice. And so I had to modify them for my own game, where I give you a lot more give and take within the rule mechanism itself. So you could be a lot more creative in your attempts to make your goals, such as using a spell, an ability, alternative concept, or just some good old-fashioned role-playing if you do it right, to affect the mechanisms. So that way you're doing a cattle drive, and you fail, and suddenly they all go off a cliff.
Yeah.
That sucks. Now you have something to deal with. Now you got to fail forward and figure out how you're going to resolve this issue.
Yeah. You know, I think this kind of will segue nicely into our next bit, which is house rules.
Oh, yes.
You know, because let's face it, the rethinking an encounter sometimes requires some house rules, and whether or not you use them, or whatever you want to talk about in terms of house rules. This was kind of a second topic that was brought up with us. And I don't know, show of hands, as they say, have you ever used house rules? I would say yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I only ask that because I have actually met people say they've never house ruled anything.
I'm trying to wonder how you would do that.
I don't know. And I've met players that have said, unless it's in the rule book, I don't want to play it that unless it's in the rule book. And a lot of times it's because, well, they know parts of the rule book are broken. And a lot of times, let's face it, house rules are usually used to address things that the game master might perceive as broken or mm-hmm. in need of revision.
I use a 1 minute rule in my games where if we are playing and we run into a rule that we don't know and we can't find it in a minute, I will temporarily house rule it and move on. And then if someone finds it later on,
well, that's the way it should work.
And consider it.
You know, and I've told players that where they've argued, well, you know, I need to find this rule. You know what? I can't find it. Here's what I'm going to do now. We'll look it up later.
Yeah.
And I've actually had players not like that. Because they felt like, oh, you're just ruling against me. No, I'm not. I want to keep the game moving, and this is one way to keep the game moving.
And if it really was that important, give me the page number right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like ultimately, rulings are so crucial in running an RPG because you're not going to know everything. And a lot of the reason why the books are so freaking huge is because often they have to deal with edge cases, which may or may not come up. Usually the basic fundamentals of a game system is pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just finding those weird issues and rules that come up because gamers.
Well,
wacky ideas.
I remember reading an article in one of the old Dragon magazines which talked about, you know, the unarmed combat. And this had to do with D&D First Edition, where when you look at the rule book, there's, you know, grappling and pummeling had its own set of rules that was almost completely outside of regular combat.
Yeah, and it's like, whoa,
and
that's...
But I mean, in the article, Gax was like, you know, the quote from Gax was, it's like, says, I got talked into doing this really complex unarmed combat system. And he says, but in reality, I've kind of used these simple rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I think that's it. It's like, I mean, that's the thing. Actually, if you sit down, that's when I don't buy when people say, I don't ever use a house rule. Well, technically, if you've read it, you know, in the old Dragon magazine, mm-hmm. when you read an article, that was not an official rule. Unless honestly, it was said it was an official rule. Like, most of the stuff that Gax wrote in the Sorcerer's Scroll, mm-hmm. those were considered official rules. Anything else in the magazine was considered, you know, house rules.
A lot of their broken NPC classes and
yeah.
weirdly powered monsters. And
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Would you consider getting an item from, say, one module and bringing it to another one to be considered a house rule of some sort?
Maybe.
You know, like, for example, the U trilogy has some really awesome, like the wand of the squid and the shafts of shock. You get them, you pick them up, and then you go on to the next level. Those items were only able to be found on that thing unless you had a GM creative. Or something like Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, where you come out with ray guns and you only have like 6 charges, but you want to bring them to the next adventure. Just to see what happens.
Right. You know, I mean, and that's... Yeah, I don't know if I'd consider those house rules.
Okay.
But it is... But it does... You have to decide whether or not that's something that you want to continue to allow. I mean, it's a tough one. So maybe.
Yeah.
I'd put that in the maybe column.
That's fair. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's temporary and there's permanent house rules. And so, like, you know, we just talked about a lot of temporary house rules... but then there's, you know, like you also said previously, there's the permanent house rules where you need to fix something. You know, this weapon can't do this much damage. You know, the MDC versus SDC in Palladium.
Oh, yeah. That's...
There's probably at least a dozen different ways I've heard of doing that.
Honestly, the best way to do it is just to get MDC out of the system entirely and see where it leads. Because unless you're building a character, ultimately... If you're playing a Rifts game and you're not playing an MDC creature in some way, shape, or form, it's just a matter of when. It's not a matter of if.
Yeah.
You know. Or, I guess the best example I can think of is good old-fashioned second edition D&D, where no two games were played the same.
Mm.
You know, I know of at least 4 different versions of the ways people ruled perception. They usually were house rules in some way, shape, or form. you know, to avoid the surprise or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've seen people use attributes, I've seen people make it a dedicated skill using the MWPs, and ultimately, for all the faults of third, that's one thing I kind of appreciate is having a universal perception check, even if they split it up to begin with.
You know, I'm going to go further. I mean, I guess I started playing D&D, you know, first edition AD&D.
Yeah.
And I would say house rules existed a lot during that period.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
You know, everything from, you know, sometimes I've seen skills added on to the characters because a lot of, you know, let's face it, AD&D first edition, not a lot of skills. Not really.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think they only existed in two places, either like the thieve skills themselves or, you know, something within the character class itself. Or there was those weird background skills, I think, that you would get sometimes if you looked in the...
Yeah, they were in the DMG, yeah.
Which was never really well explained. It was just something that was in there.
Yep. Yeah, here's some secondary skills.
Yeah.
Let your GM decide what the hell you can actually do with them.
Exactly. But, I mean, that was a lot of games back then. You know,
well, I mean, also, I mean, the house rule that everybody probably didn't know that they were using is how many people actually had spell components.
Yeah, most people
ignored. If you didn't have spell components, you couldn't cast a lot of your spells, especially as a magic user.
Right.
So,
yeah, and
if
I mean,
you weren't using spell components.
And even the cleric, most of the typical spell component was actually more of a focus. It was you had to have your holy symbol.
Right. So, you know, that would be a house rule, even though you didn't know you were house ruling it, because seriously, getting all those components talk about a mini game, that's kind of a maxi game. That's an entirely different beast.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I mean, honestly, that the house rules that people kind of used and is what morphed into, I think, what happened in Pathfinder, which was basically, you know, anything that's listed as having a spell component, unless it's actually spelled out, you just have this component pouch that has random stuff in it, and it has a number of uses.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, how many people you even use that?
I would say almost none.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I know as a player, as a game master, unless it was something that was super expensive, I didn't care.
Encumbrance is another one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do. I think encumbrance is just a lot of people thought it was, you know, just point counting. You know,
it's bookkeeping. Yeah.
Yeah, it's bookkeeping. The problem is the encumbrance is there for a reason.
Yes.
And it's because if you really get down to it, you can defeat the big bad guy, and there could be tons of treasure, but how the fuck are you supposed to haul it out? In modern games...
And I do use that. I do use the common sense encumbrance in my games.
Right,
like,
but
yeah,
I mean,
there's
just...
5,000 gold pieces here, but you cannot carry it out.
Right.
What's funny is Hackmaster actually created a few spells specifically to get around that. They have a first level spell called Pool Gold, which allows you to convert all the gold, you know, the coins in the area to the smallest possible currency. So if you got 5,000 copper pieces, they become, you know, 50 gold pieces.
Interesting.
Well, it's kind of one of those fun little things that came out necessity of demand. Okay, I got a house rule for you guys. And it actually could date back to the first edition here. You know, the thief in D&D actually was probably one of the weakest classes back in the day. But somebody created one of the greatest house rules for the first edition that I ever saw. Instead of rolling the percentiles, you look at the, you know, hear noise based on 1d6. Every other character can get a 1 on a 1d6. But only the thief starts at 2 out of a 2d6. It goes up over time for any of the thief abilities, such as climbing walls or, you know, stealth or what have you. And by basing on a d6, you have a better chance of actually succeeding on the damn thing.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I think you brought... one was brought up in the pre-show, which was spells and like spell points, especially in D&D.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people try to switch to some sort of system like that.
Yep.
You know, I've used other games that had spell points, and I was like, okay, makes kind of sense, because then, okay, first level spellcaster can cast more than one spell. You know, okay, that's kind of cool. But that said, I don't think it usually all it did was make the magic user more powerful rather than actually solving the
problem.
Well,
I think also, house rules are great, but like anything, when you start poking and prodding things, especially like a game system, and you put in a house rule, well, you can cast spells as many times as your intelligence bonus. All of a sudden, a level or two on, this person's, you know, casting entire, the sky is full of magic missiles or sleep spells or whatever, and your character's walking through every encounter, and you're like, ah, that didn't work out quite the way I'd hoped. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, house rules are great, but you do need to be, you know, keep a kind of a monitor on them and negotiate with your players. Like, yeah, I know we were using this up to that point to kind of balance this out, but we can see in practice that this doesn't work at all. You quickly become too powerful, or it's too limiting or not limiting enough or whatever. So,
like, it almost feels like before you do house rules, you almost have to decide what you want to do with them. Like, yes. I played around with the 3rd edition magic system to make my D-Rev RPG stuff. I experimented with spell points, managed to use them, but I also included a spell malfunction table because I'm always under the impression that if magic feels like you're doing science, you're doing it wrong. It's an art. And as a result, it is very unstable by its very nature. Otherwise, you'd just be using technology or science. And that's when you get the wacky issues, because you're trying to essentially channel the energies of the universe by wiggling your hands and saying silly words. And the only reason you're doing able to succeed at it is because you're that damn good.
Hmm. Okay.
And also, I think I won't lie to you, part of it was influenced by the old D&D cartoon, where he had a magic pad that you tried to pull damn anything out, and he always usually ended up being silly as hell until he figured out what the hell he was doing with it. And mm-hmm. It's fun, like, you are going to remember, going back to the encounter one, if you cast a spell and you end up giving everybody flatulence instead of actually having the desired effect.
I don't know why, but I was just thinking of the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon. And I remember when they got all their magic items taken, and I think there was a group of lizardmen that were using them better than they could.
Yeah, I remember that. That was funny. But yeah.
So.
And, you know, part of the fun is just, like, I would say, if you're going to use a house rule, one, it has to be agreed with by the group. Two, you have to find out why you're doing it. Like, don't do change rules just for the sake of changing rules.
Well, because, right. I mean, it's like, for example, one of the house rules that I borrowed from Ardwin at one point was hit points. Because they had a system of hit points that was based on your race and your constitution, you got a certain amount of hit points. And then you only got like maybe like one additional hit point per level for most people, mm-hmm. if that. And so what happened is that first level characters were harder to kill, but it meant that if you were 10th level, you were not untouchable. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, so in the theory, in the example they gave in the one rule book was, okay, let's this way, a first level fighter and a 10th level fighter can stand back to back and they have an equal chance of dying if they get hit. Mm-hmm. What was the argument? The argument was that, you know, they didn't like the whole where hit points are, and you know, because the hit points were originally described as this sort of a combination of things, not just necessarily, you know, how much physical damage you could take, but, you know, like maybe how fast you could recover after getting hit, you know,
fatigue and all that other stuff.
And it's just like, yeah, because then it becomes, you know, especially with higher level characters, it's like, I'm a fighter and I have, I don't know, 72 hit points. Well, you know, there's not a lot that will do 72 points of damage. You know, you can't be taken down with one sword stroke, no matter how lucky, typically.
True.
You know, and so that was the argument. The argument was, well, you know, that doesn't, you know, the rule system, you know, you create, especially with hit points, you create this system where someone can't get a lucky shot and kill the most dangerous person on the planet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like, that just ruins the ability to tell certain stories, because, well, why would that person die from a single arrow shot? Well, it was an assassin. Really? You know, you have to create reasons for things.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Well, again, I always think of that legendary comic where you see a peasant's village, people are going around their business, and this guy comes screaming in saying, everybody run for your lives, there's a 20th level fighter that only needs 5 XP to go up to level 21.
Nice.
And it's kind of the same idea where mechanics can dictate the type of stories you're doing.
Right.
Another popular house rule was the critical failure and critical success rules, which I don't think actually exist in 1E, in the first edition of AD&D. I don't believe there are crit rules, but I practically every GM and every player I've ever met, it has had their own version of critical success and critical failure.
Yeah, the closest thing to that in the actual rules per se are the verbal sword rules.
Yeah. And your version heads off. Although back in second edition, they had the combat and tactics random, you know, critical hit table. And even though they were horribly broken, if you got lucky, it got balanced out because the monster could do the same darn thing to you guys. And it made combat a lot more chaotic. Unfortunately, that also means that a single rule could end up decapitating your character and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and if you've got a sixth level fighter who gets decapitated by a, you know, a single lucky bugbear, I could see how players might be a little disappointed in that.
I'm trying to think of other things that were house rules. Definitely always skills, what a person knows.
What about when a house rule system becomes its own game? Like, I guess the best example I can think of it is Hackmaster, which started as a joke, but its foundation is based on first and second edition. You know, built such a degree that it became its own entity.
Well, we were actually talking a little bit about that earlier before the show with rules like Rule 46 dropped the lowest. That wasn't technically an official rule until later games.
Mm-hmm.
But almost everyone used that as the house rule. That was almost like the way everyone did it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, you know, and I think that's the thing. People don't realize, you know, I've run into people that argue that I don't use any house rules. Oh, how can you not? I think it is impossible. People tend to think that, you know, I don't know. I think it's when either 3.5 or 4.0 came out that people just kind of, I had some people tell me that basically like house rules was a dirty word for them. And I'm just like, I don't think so.
Well, if you think about it logistically, you're talking about a rule book that is sometimes in excess of 200 pages long. Now, there might be a few very talented individuals out there who can remember every single rule in that rule book, but most of us are mere mortals.
Hell, I can't remember what I had for breakfast.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way you can keep in your brain every single rule in that book. Now, you can go diving after each one of them during every encounter, but that makes for a really slow and boring game.
But it's just easier
to hand wave and deal with it later or not at all.
I will say this. I think because of the aids that I learned, AD&D First Edition, I probably remember more of those rules than any other game I've played since.
I would probably agree with that.
Well, it's your first, and as a result, it's the shiny new thing when you first start role-playing.
Well, I will also argue this. The AD&D, between AD&D and 2nd Edition, and 2nd Edition, 3rd, and 3rd and 4th, the time between editions was the 1st Edition to 2nd Edition was the greatest length of time than any of the other editions. The editions have actually come faster as time has progressed.
Actually, I thought 4th to 5th was actually a longer period. I could be wrong, though.
No, I don't think so.
Well, I know 2nd Edition was around for a heck of a long time. It was running from 88 to 99. Yeah. And one of the reasons they had a 3rd edition is because TSR died.
Yeah.
And they tried to essentially...
Because I want to say AD&D, the first one, was almost like 12 or 13 years, something ridiculous.
Well, I suppose it came out in 78... 79. So yeah, that would make it. Yeah.
The DMG, the copyright that I have is 79.
Okay.
So, you know, and I mean, you know, it's like, I don't know, when did 2nd E come out?
Yeah, I thought it was like 86, 87 or something.
For 2nd edition?
Yeah. Then we want to find out. We have the internet.
I'm looking up right now.
Well, in the meantime.
Oh, hold on.
Yes, it comes down to, what do you want to do with it?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of those house rule systems also
77 I think they to 89
get out of hand too, especially if you bring them to like a convention. That's one of the reasons that Gygax said that they're, you know, that the books are there is that if you go to a convention, you should try to adhere as closely as possible to the books, because that puts everybody on an equal footing.
Yeah.
If you have 3 pages of house rules, that, you know, the people who know you can exploit those house rules, because everybody's exploiting the rules to their own benefit. Mm-hmm. And your new players, you're like, well, I didn't know I could cast again. Like, well, I explained that at the beginning. Well, you explained 30 other rules at the beginning of the game too, before we started. So, I mean, there is something to be said for, you know, keeping the core rules in mind too.
Yeah, and also it's fun to see another creator take an idea and change the world because of it. Like, I'm going to be involved in a Mists and Akumas game on Friday, and it's basically a Japanese mythology rule, but it's built with a 5e engine. So it'll be fun to see what changes occur because of that. You know, different eyes, same system.
Yep.
It's not quite, you know, basically it's the next step above a house rule when you build essentially a house world.
True.
You know, and let's be honest, almost everybody has, who's ever played D&D, has their own world, or at least enough of it to play around with it. Mm-hmm. You know, you have that one little place, you basically build your own stock fantasy world, and you basically try to put a few twists in it.
Yeah, even no two Forgotten Realms are exactly the same.
Exactly. And that's part of the fun of, well, that's part of the fun of gaming.
Yep.
Taking a world and making it your own.
Alrighty. I think we're going to leave the house rules at that point, because we're going to run out of time here. We actually have gone pretty far.
So when did second edition come out, real quick?
Okay, yeah. Edition-wise, 89. It came
89.
Yeah,
okay, that's what I thought. Yeah, it came across from my
opinion. Yeah. AD&D first edition is kind of weird because the Monster Manual came out in 77, Player's Handbook in 78, DMG in 79.
That's kind of weird how the Monster Manual came out first.
Well, especially considering the rules for character creation are in the DMG. So the Player's Handbook wouldn't technically do you any good.
Well, the assumption with AD&D was that you probably own the original D&D, which was in 74. Mm-hmm. And so you bought the Monster Manual, and you were just using the original rules with the Monster Manual. And then you got the Player's Handbook, and obviously you were just using the creation rules, you know, the, whatever you were doing for the original, until you got the DMG. I agree. It's kind of weird how that panned out. So that said, if you use 77 as the initial start date for AD&D, which is kind of, that's an iffy.
Yeah.
If you just use 79, that's 10 years for the first edition. Which would make second edition actually 11 years.
Yeah.
From 89 to 2000. And then from the third edition to 3.5 is 3 years. From 3.5 to 4, 2008, so that's 5. And then from 2008 to 5th edition is 2014, so that's 6 years. Okay. So basically, you're right. Probably 2nd edition has the longest run, although some would argue since AD&D was really just a compilation of the original Dungeons & Dragons Onward, that's
a codified version of the,
Yeah. So
again, 1st edition and 2nd edition really weren't all that different, at least when they started out.
Yeah. So, but you
know, it wasn't like a total overhaul or anything like
that. Well, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, but I mean, we're talking, each one of those had 10, 11 years for those editions where, you know, you look at the recent, you know, from 3rd to 4th, that's only 8 years, which is not bad. Although you throw 3.5 in there, and which a lot of people would say, I don't play 3, I have to play 3.5.
Yeah.
That they almost consider 3.5 a actual revision. Or
is where 4E had a year and a half where they had the essentials, where they basically tried to overhaul the system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is, like I said, really kind of interesting. You know, and I mean, that's just D&D. I mean, other games I've played, hey, it's time to release a new edition. And a lot, like you said, has to do with the way the companies are. So,
exactly.
All right. Anything else before we close out?
Nope.
All right. Well, I do have an announcement. I think the last time I talked about the fact that I have these iTunes gift cards that I have no use for, since I don't use iTunes. Mm-hmm. I come to find that I have 4 of these things. Each one is $25.
Nice.
Now, I got these as gifts for my credit card points. That's just the way my credit card is. I don't know. It's a long story why that is. I don't really like it, but it's like it's a credit card I have, and I can't change to a different point system. So anytime I use the credit card, I'm still going to get points that will eventually give me an iTunes gift card that I don't use. So I have four of these. So my thought is what I would do is those of you out there who actually send us an actual, from this point forward, I can't count the ones that we've already received, I'm sorry, but from this episode forward, if you send me an idea and we use it, I will send you the gift card for us using that idea until we've expended all the gift cards that we have. Fair enough?
Good to me.
You think?
That works.
Yeah. That way we get some ideas for some topics, and we get a little subjectiveness because then we get to decide, well, someone's just not going to suggest something to obviously get a gift card. It has to be something that we will probably use, and we have to use it.
Oh, agreed. And on top of that, we'd like to hear your own house rules and what you've used in your games.
So exactly. So you can send us the ideas at info@rpgcircus.com. You can send us comments at info@rpgcircus.com. If you go to our Facebook page or our rpgcircus.com homepage, you can send us a voicemail up. That's where I'd like to hear about the house rules, personally, because then we can play them on the air. I don't have to read them.
That's me.
And then, of course, you know, besides the card, you'll get some stickers, too, since I still have some. So if you, you know, if you just want stickers, you can send me an message at info@rpgcircus.com. Just tell me that you heard about our contest, but you don't plan to participate. That's not fair enough.
Sounds good.
That sounds good.
Alrighty. So we will see everyone in just about 2 weeks then, I believe. Okay. Alrighty. And we'll see you then. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.